feminism. One word, but with wildly conflicting interpretations and experiences attached.
It's a shame because I'd like to think that I'm a big feminist and I'm proud of that, but then when I'm around certain boys or groups of people, I don't feel comfortable telling people I'm a feminist.
The feminist movement has always been pushed by white women, and that's not necessarily a bad thing because historically that has led us to the progress we have now. But women are not just women, they're also black, they're also gay, there are also lots of other things, and all these things impact their experiences as women.
Obviously there's definitely work to be done. Maybe it's just because I don't tend to socialise in circles in which there is a lot of anti-feminist sentiment.
A lot of people can label themselves as a feminist and then just be like very subjective about it.
Fuck feminism. I'd rather be paid for by a man.
Those voices belong to just some of the teens I've interviewed about feminism over the last few years. Interestingly, only around a third of young men and just over a half of young women identify as feminist, which when you consider Gen Z are meant to be all about equality and rights for all, that seems kind of counterintuitive. I think it's fair to say that very few people would denounce their support for movements about equality and justice by way of race or sexuality. But at its core, feminism is about equal rights for men and women. So why are so many teenagers rejecting it? In short, some feel threatened by its existence, some feel excluded from the movement, and others feel their lives are just, well, easier without it. This is You Don't Know Me. I'm Chloe Cumby. When I was interviewing the girls for this episode, an expression I'd never heard came up again and again. Pick me girls.
I'm not like other girls. That is literally,
it's like the summary of
them. Oh no, it's always like, oh my god, I'm so much smaller than you. Like, I'm so small. You're so tall. Yeah. Like, oh my god, my hand can literally fit into your face. Oh my god.
There's your hand.
According to the girls, and some of the boys, pick me girls is kind of like the Gen Z version of water carriers for the patriarchy. Girls who, in person or on social media, say things like, I don't believe in feminism. Boys are the big brave sex. I just believe my role is to serve beer during sports and give head. As Lilla, Maya and Frances, all aged 17, are telling me here, pick me girls will always separate themselves from, quote, other girls and boast how much they are not like them.
By saying this whole, I'm not like other girls, it reinforces this image, this stereotypical how image of what girls are like, which is why it's so problematic saying I'm not like other girls, because what are other girls like?
They always implies there's something wrong with other
girls.
Yeah,
exactly. Which
and I
there
think
isn't.
They turn themselves into what the classical stereotype of a girl should be, like, oh my god, I'm so good at cooking. Seriously, I'll cook you a meal. Like, I don't do this, I don't do that. I don't go out a lot with my friends. I'm just really chill. I stay at home.
Or like they take abuse from boys. Like when boys make jokes like, oh, you're such a dishwasher. Like go back
maybe
to the kitchen
sandwich.
Kind of thing. Yeah, they're those girls that would be like, yeah, like I'll make you a sandwich. Haha. Like I'm such a dishwasher. Haha. Like that kind of thing.
But boys like that.
You're asking the wrong girls.
When you go to a girls' school and like you don't hang out with boys and girls,
girls change
a lot around boys.
How so?
Like the way they act,
they'll
like
put other girls down. Themselves, talking about maybe insecurities another girl has, or speaking about something she's done to put her down to lift them up.
The pick me phrase is perfect to describe women with internalized misogyny who put other people down or who are all like, oh, I'm not like other girls.
I don't do this.
Yeah.
I love football.
Yeah. I stuff my face with pizza. Oh, I'm not like other girls. Yeah, it's all of that kind of thing. Like, I think that's what you see the most going from being in an all-girls environment to mixing it with boys. It can kind of show your people's true colours that you wouldn't see otherwise, which I think is why that there's more conflict when there's boys involved, because people change when there's boys involved.
If you're a Gen Z girl today, chances are you'll have heard of the term pick me girls already. You might even be able to think of a few in your Insta feed or in your class at school. I couldn't help but think there was something more systemic to this. Frances helped me understand the seemingly vicious cycle from a different perspective.
women have been brought up with this internalised misogyny against other women that's actually as damaging as men being misogynistic to women, because it's like they don't realise they're doing it. So even like slut-shaming or calling someone a bitch is something that women do quite a lot. Women love gossiping. Like,
why do you think women do that to each other?
I think it's a mixture of, firstly, internalised misogyny. So they see a woman acting a way in society wouldn't usually like, or maybe not dressing up, not caring about their appearance, and they judge women on that because they hold society's standards against them, and they say, these women aren't trying to be pretty, why not? They should be, like... But I think it's also about women's own insecurities being projected onto other women. So saying to another woman, or thinking about another woman, oh, she's intimidating. Is she intimidating, or are you just intimidated by her confidence?
It feels like Frances's point of view about internalised misogyny could be applied to both sides of the coin here, doesn't it? Pick-me girls could be accused of forcing a perceived stereotype on the, quote, other girls to free themselves of the damaging stereotypes like man-hating and hysterical, quote, feminazis to seem more attractive to the boys they fancy. It makes them look fuss-free, chilled out, perfect girlfriend material. On the other hand, Gen Z girls who do not behave like pick-me girls are every bit as guilty of judging the girls who choose to do so. There is still a sense of them and us. I was left thinking, can you be a pick-me girl and also be a feminist? Can you be a feminist and approve of a pick-me girl? There is clearly a clash here, and these discussions have revealed to me that there is still a lot of work to be done to create a unified understanding of feminism. Jasmine is 16. She also brought up pick-me girls when we were discussing feminism and explained what she thought the catalyst was that caused some women to separate themselves from others.
Do you think girls support girls, or do you think girls are more prone to tear girls apart?
Both. I think overall there is a sense of girls do support girls. Like, you go in a girl's post, you go in the comments, you're really pretty, oh my god, I love this, you're so funny, blah, blah, blah. And you see like loads of comments, you see loads of supportive comments, but then at the same time, there are some girls, I think we refer to them as pick-me girls.
This keeps coming up. Tell me what a pick-me girl is.
Pick-me girls are like girls that say things, you know, like, I'm not like other girls, I'm different, you know, be with me, I want to pick me.
Do you think that's because they think it's a way to attract guys?
Yeah.
Why would boys be attracted to that?
Because, so, okay, I came across this the other day on TikTok. There was this girl, and I think under all of her posts, everyone's just commenting, pick me. And it's because she is basically tearing down feminism. She's like, girls are horrible, we do all of this trash, and all the boys are like, yeah, we like this.
So do you feel there is this war? Why is it that guys would like that and girls essentially wouldn't? What's the conflict?
I think there is a war, but I think it's more than just like boys and girls. I think it's commonly referred to as the girls and the gays, cis straight men. I think that's where the war is. I mean, not all straight men, but...
Girls and gays are on one side.
Yeah.
And cis straight men are on another.
Yeah, that's what it's referred to as.
It seems to me that pick-me girls tick a lot of boxes for young men who see feminism as man-hating and threatening. Detaching themselves from feminism seems to be the way these girls gain validation from boys and ultimately bag themselves a boyfriend. During all these conversations about pick-me girls, it became clear that the catalyst of much praise or criticism about a teen was social media for their actions and beliefs, but even more so, their appearance. I've been doing an experiment for a decade now where I ask a group of girls to choose hypothetically between beauty or brains. They go to the left side of the room for beauty and right for intelligence. When I first did this in 2010 or so, there was about a 60-40 split favouring beauty. Now it's 80-90% of the girls on the left. I asked Frances, one of the girls from earlier, about why she thought looks played such a major role in women's lives.
Women are made to feel like their only purpose is to please men and to look good. It's capitalism. People make money off women feeling inadequate because they spend money buying tummy tees and waist trainers and stuff like that, that actually doesn't really do anything, but it's sold to them in a way that it's going to make them more worthy in society, which isn't true at all.
The cosmetics and beauty industry was worth over £1 trillion in 2019 alone. Last year, millions of cosmetic surgery procedures were carried out from the minor, like Botox, referred to in the industry as a tweakment, to the major, like a BBL. That's a Brazilian butt lift, by the way. 92% of these procedures were performed on women. To Francis's point, the beauty industry first creates anxiety, then offers to fix it. And man, are those fixes making the industry rich and women more and more competitive.
This idea of privilege, male privilege, that they go through life and they do suffer, but a large part of their suffering isn't caused by their gender. In the same way that white privilege, white people can suffer. That's not what white privilege is about. It's about the fact that they never have to suffer because of their race, because they're never at a disadvantage in the workplace or anywhere in society because of their race. I'm a white girl with blonde hair and I'm not plus size and I'm cisgender and stuff. So I have to admit that I'm at a place of privilege. I've got society's pretty privilege as well. As women, it's so hard to admit that you have pretty privilege because women are also conditioned to be modest.
Desirability privilege is a term used often among groups of Generation Z, online and offline, along with white privilege, thin privilege, pretty privilege. I could go on. These terms symbolise the privilege afforded to those born with Western-constructed desirability ideals, such as whiteness, thinness and being able-bodied. Gen Z are using terminology like this daily to address biases that previously would have been swept under the rug by older generations. I've got to say, I was so impressed by the breadth of the vocabulary and knowledge of these young women. They have a deep understanding of what the patriarchy is, as well as the way it directly impacts their lives, and they use terms such as intersectionality to discuss where feminism intersects with race. The rejection of feminism isn't always born out of a voluntary dislike for the practices. We can't forget that feminism was invented by white, middle-class women, and has continued to serve this category of society as a priority ever since. As Frances touched on just now, women of colour are still not afforded the same privileges as white women in the feminist discussion. I want to introduce you to Keza, a young black woman who attends a mostly white, famous and very expensive boarding school in the UK. She's there on a full scholarship. We met at a youth organisation in East London that I worked with throughout my research with young people.
I was in such two minds on whether I even wanted to go. The whole concept seemed so exciting, like a sleepover in school, both which I kind of liked. But I also really loved my friends at my old school. Some of them I'm still quite close with, which is quite nice.
She's 17, in sixth form, and lives in London, when not at school.
Leave my friends, leave everything that I know, because East London is pretty much where I've grown up kind of thing.
This was the first time I'd met Keza. We'd spoken about stereotypes, cultural appropriation and friendships. And I found it really revealing to hear about her experience as a black woman in a mostly white school.
Maybe I was a nerd. Maybe I wasn't very sociable. But trying to fit in with people that I didn't really recognise was quite difficult, along with being one of two black girls in the whole year. I was suddenly an exotic creature, which was just a bit strange to me because... Great. My old school...
What was the ratio in...
There was a lot more black people in my old school. It was a lot more comfortable. I would say I could be my true authentic self. I could be as loud as I wanted.
Do you think black women are sexualised differently to white women?
Yeah, 100%. And the more racially ambiguous that you are, the better. For example, depending on the crowd, black women are either super loved or completely ignored. So when I was in school, me and another black friend, like, we were just either one of the boys or just one of the girls. We're just never seen as anything other than that. Like, we're never seen as anyone you could be in a relationship with, possibly because of your family, and you would never be accepted or whatever the reasons. But it's literally one or the other, where you're like this exotic creature of a different land and all that jazz, which I find very weird because I'm literally human. And you're kind of expected to know things like, oh, do you know how to twerk or things like that? And it's like, no, I'm not that great of a dancer. Like, I will jump up and down just like you. It's like, no, I don't know how to rap and all that kind of thing.
Keza experiences a double whammy of marginalisation, both as a woman and as a black woman.
I would say I kind of had to tone down myself in certain aspects just to kind of put myself in palatable amounts so people could kind of accept you more. Because if you're this loud, black, aggressive girl, then it's just like, why are you shouting all the time? And it's like, I'm just loud and bubbly kind of thing. And that's how I've kind of always been.
Yeah. That's quite sad, though, that you... Do you feel that you have to make less of yourself?
Yes, it's sad, but it's kind of have to know your audience. I know who I can be my authentic self around, even my white friends. But in a new environment, you kind of have to be careful because, you know, impressions last and you kind of be painted in a picture where you've made an assumption and now you don't want to get to know me.
One of the most enduring and toxic stereotypes is that of the angry black woman. And certainly you see this perpetuated in everything from TV dramas to insults thrown at prominent black women in the public eye. But hearing a teenager discuss how she already has to check herself at school is really jarring and a reminder that while feminism is empowering for some, it certainly isn't for all.
We're always homogenised, and that's something that really irks me. It's like, you're black, you have to be curvaceous, you have to have big boobs, you wear a weave. Sometimes I feel like white people can be individuals, but as a black person, you do something wrong, you're doing something wrong for your whole race.
What about the colourism thing? Do you think that there's more different perceptions of, like, darkness, or do you think, is there, like, a kind of an aspirational, like, you know, the whole light skin thing?
I think back in the day, it was, like, this thing, it's like, where you'd make fun of dark girls on the bus on the way to school or something. So, yeah, the lighter you were or more racially ambiguous you were, the more attractive you were to finding a boyfriend or whatever.
The interesting thing is that white women are now, let's say, appropriating and aspiring to black features.
I genuinely believe it all started with Kim K. Like, honestly, don't get me started. They want to take certain... How do I word? It sometimes feels like they're taking certain aspects that we are constantly ridiculed for and then putting it within their community or within themselves. And next minute, it's this new, crazy new thing. And, oh, I got lip fillers. Look how beautiful my lips are. And it's like, I was made fun of my lips. Now it's okay. Why is it that it's okay with you, but it's not okay with me? Yeah. It's obviously because you're white and I'm black.
Many demographics of women feel like feminism and female empowerment has happened at the expense of them, not with them or for them. I wanted to meet one of the modern feminist icons for many teenage girls today, a woman enlightening girls on the breadth of discussion under the feminism umbrella, so to speak. And one of the people introducing them to terms and concepts and beliefs that make feminism a very attractive and cool movement to support.
Florence Given.
Feminist artist, influencer and author Florence Given is known to her friends and fans as Floss. She's 21, a Gen Z herself. As I'm recording this episode, Floss's book, Women Don't Owe You Pretty, has made her a Sunday Times bestseller for 12 consecutive weeks. And it's been soul food for women of all ages, but particularly teenage women, who are grappling with challenging concepts that impact their everyday lives. I wanted to ask Floss about both pick-me-girl culture and internalised misogyny, as well as intersectional feminism. I kick things off by asking her about my looks or intelligence experiment and why she thinks more young women would choose beauty over smarts.
Why do you think that is?
Social media.
Okay, tell me more.
It's this heightened state of curating your body. It's this heightened need to display ourselves. I think social media, if you view it as an art form, as an illusion, view these people as avatars, it becomes less of reality. But I think because we do view social media as like someone's entire reality, when in fact it is a curated 5% of that person's life that they are deciding to show you, we buy into the lie that that is how they always are. So why aren't we always also this amazing version? So then we show the bits of ourselves that we are proud of, that we want to, that are highlight reel. That's what social media is often described as, a highlight reel. And then we feel shit about not living up to that standard of ourselves that we have set. I think we're constantly being reinforced that image is everything, but also told looks don't matter. I hate the phrase looks don't matter because they do. They fucking do. You know, we live in a world where you will be afforded more opportunities because of how you look. I'm an example of that. I have so much quote unquote desirability privilege where people listen to me because of my whiteness or my thinness and all of this kind of stuff that gives me this privilege. I find it interesting, the intelligence or the looks. It's really interesting because I think women know that if you do choose the intelligence, you will be ignored. And if you choose the looks, you will be desired, but you won't be taken as seriously and people will constantly be undermining you and all of this stuff. So it's like, what do you choose? Do you want to be seen or heard?
It blew my mind thinking the age-old saying, children should be seen and not heard, is very much alive and present in today's society towards women and girls, except it's hidden and internalised. We're just not being as honest as they were about it back in the day.
There's so much pressure for women to receive respect or attention or whatever we're told, this void that we need to fill. And again, it's all a distraction. It's all a distraction from loving ourselves. And again, that's such a vague thing to say, but what does loving yourself look like? It means saying no to things. It means isolating yourself for a bit while you get your shit together and you realize what's important to you. It means taking inventory of the things that you say yes to. It means not burning yourself out. It means standing up to people when they disrespect you. We are distracted from doing all this stuff because we don't care about doing things. We care about what we look like while we do things because that's how we're socialized. And if women are too busy thinking about what they look like while they're doing things, it slows us down. It slows the whole movement down. There's so much nuance to this conversation because your looks can advance you and get you through doors if you quote unquote play the game, but then it also slows you down in the process because you're also thinking about what you look like. You can't win. You cannot win as a woman in this world, because if you don't do the stuff, the pretty stuff, people will ignore you. They won't listen to you. And if you do the pretty stuff, people will look at you for a while. And then when they realize that you actually have a voice, they don't care about you or they belittle your voice.
I could understand why this was so problematic when it came to women struggling with the patriarchy. But what about women clashing with other women? Why were we seeing this manifest into the likes of Pick Me Girls or the exclusion of women of color?
I think literally everything is a distraction. Marriage is a distraction. Finding a boyfriend is a distraction. Hating other women is a distraction. I'm not shaming marriage. I'm not shaming women who want to fuck and casually date men. I'm saying that all of these things that we are encouraged to put paramount importance on are distractions from loving ourselves, from healing our shit, from getting our shit together, from banding together and forming communities. Because if we did that, the world wouldn't be able to fucking handle that power. The world would not be able to handle the power of women and non-binary people, and of queer people, of people of color actually coming together and shaking shit up. Like, it wouldn't be able to handle it because we are so powerful. We have a righteous anger. And I think the more that we become aware of our oppression, the more powerful we become. And I think patriarchy and capitalism and white supremacy is afraid of that because this system is benefiting, you know, a select few. And I think, absolutely. It's like the crabs in a bucket syndrome. Have you heard of that analogy?
I haven't actually. Tell me.
When female crabs are in a bucket, they've just been caught in the bucket from the fisher person or whatever, and they're in the bucket, they can actually all help each other escape the bucket, but they don't. Instead, they if one is like about to escape the bucket, they will all work to tear that one down and they all die together.
Wow.
So that's called the crabs in a bucket syndrome of, we don't want one of us to escape, we're all gonna like keep each other down.
I As we address the question of why young people today are rejecting feminism, it's impossible to escape the constant and relevant reference to the patriarchy and how the sexes are clashing in today's society. I wanted to hear from some boys. It's time to meet Stephen, who sits at an extreme end of the spectrum in his opinions about feminism.
Feminism is like a cancer for men and women.
I know. He could pass for being in his late 20s, but Stephen is actually 19. He lives in Massachusetts in the United States. As you can tell, he is not a fan of what he perceives as feminism. But if you feel the temptation to cancel him for his staunchly anti-feminist views, I think we should try to give him some context. He's a teenage boy growing up in the age of the internet, an age where news is clickbait, where cancel culture exists, where accusations go viral. He told me himself that he thinks
there's a definite conspiracy to make men, especially white men, look bad.
And he flat out thinks toxic masculinity is bullshit. Don't get me wrong. This isn't me justifying his opinions, but more explaining why he might hold them. And I think it's important to hear him out, as his views aren't in isolation at all.
I think feminism gets two things wrong. It tells girls that they're victims and that men are scary and there needs to be a movement against them. And it just tells young men that they're bad. And in order to be good men, they have to be like pussies and soft. Well, why does there need to be some kind of movement to tell people what's right and wrong about anything? What's it done but made absolutely everything worse? No one knows what the fuck they're supposed to do or say, and everyone's just terrified of being social or dating or shit. Because you put your hand on someone's knee, and a couple of nights later, the feds are going to be knocking at your door. That happened to a friend of mine in college. And like, if you know this guy, you'd know he wouldn't do anything violent. He's like this southern gentleman. But there was barely even a trial. Dude got kicked out of school, got death threats, and would have got a criminal record. But the girl, she withdrew the accusation. And it turned out that she'd done it to other guys. That's what feminism does to people. It turns them into fucking monsters.
Feminism turns them into monsters. Whoa. Is this a battle cry of a young man rendered insecure by feminism, or the way a lot of young men feel, even the ones who won't say it so openly? Speaking to Stephen made me question whether his position was defensive and fearful, but as it's a view held by many others, we can't just brush it off, even if we'd like to. Stephen says he doesn't hate women. After all, he has a girlfriend and girls who are friends. He says he just hates feminism. The online world has turned feminism into a kind of a monster for Stephen and lots of others. However, I have seen this hatred of feminism many, many times nastily evolve into actual hatred of women. It's a tricky one to toss up, but I can't help wonder why equality for all women makes some men feel so marginalised and uneasy. It seems to me that by some boys' reckoning, feminism has become less about equality and more about being politically correct or even enabling feminine revenge. If you feel a little bit walloped by Stephen's hardline perspective, meet Freddie. He's 18. He's down to earth and reminds me of one of the bright, nice lads we were all friends with in high school.
Would you consider yourself to be a feminist?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Would you say that in male company?
Yeah. I mean, I would be comfortable saying it. I think it's more important that you're able to say it in male company, especially if there are any people there that describe themselves as anti-feminist or anything of that variety.
Do you feel any major difference in your values, in sort of generationally speaking, from your dad?
There's definitely differences in language. That's a big thing. The kind of language of progressive movements has evolved massively from solidarity being the most crucial element to allyship being the most crucial element. That's something we see today.
This point Freddie made about language used to demonstrate support for a movement really stuck with me. Here's an example of a teen dedicated to progression in this space and willing to put his reputation with the lads on the line to stand up for what he believes in. It occurred to me that maybe some men and boys view feminism as a threat. So adjusting their use of language in the name of equality, for example, actually makes them feel as though they're losing or being forced to abandon something, in turn kind of giving them a victim mentality. Unlike other big issues at the moment, there seems to be an insistence on flat out rejecting feminism or upholding an ideological feminist purity. And these extremes are the reason some young people are put off by the movement. I don't think there's any such thing as a perfect feminist or correct feminism. If a teenager treats other people equally and with dignity, helps out other people, regardless of gender, race, or economic status, and is open to learning about new ideas, surely that's the makings of a pretty good feminist, even if they don't want to call themselves one. Another way to look at this is, like everything else today, we're realising that complex topics aren't binary, but they do exist on a kind of spectrum. There is room for everybody's kind of feminism along that spectrum. You can be more rigorous, like Florence, or you can start off gently by reading books, joining a feminist club, or having open conversations about equality with friends or family. After these, and many conversations, I have one simple question to follow up. Do you think feminism is fit for purpose for this generation? Frances was first to come back to me.
Hi, Chloe. So for the question, do you think feminism is fit for purpose for this generation? I guess I just wanted to say that, like, I feel like I've noticed that intersectional feminism is becoming increasingly popular in our generation. And to be honest, I think that this is just perfect for progression. I think it's so important that we have a movement that is inclusive of everyone. So no matter what race, size, class and sexuality they are, which is quite different to second wave feminism, which was quite exclusive of certain minorities and really focused on white middle-class women, whereas intersectional feminism, it kind of allows us to confront the discrimination women face, but at the same time, look into the other forms of oppression and privilege faced by people like racism and homophobia.
Maya said,
I thought about this question a lot. And I think it's a very interesting one because, like anything else, there's always going to be room for improvement. So in some aspects, yes, I do think it's fit for our modern society, whereas in others, not so much. I think it's given women the platform to hold society's most powerful men accountable for their actions. And not only their actions, their views as well. So it's helped us to critique our systems and our institutions.
Eve, who we heard at the very start of the episode, told me about the feminist virtue signalling online.
I know a lot of people where they are kind of feminist on social media and online, but then behind the scenes, they're still not being feminist in their everyday lives and they're still supporting toxic behaviour. And I think that's where it's a problem.
In some ways, Western girls growing up in the 20s are witnessing progress their grandmothers could only have dreamt of. They are flourishing in education, have more opportunities in the workplace, and there are increasing numbers of very successful female leaders running countries. But as women become ever closer to achieving equality, misogyny is metastasizing into something different, but just as deadly. Black women are 5 times more likely to die during childbirth compared to white women. Women online are exponentially more likely to be threatened with sexual violence. And 85,000 women ages 16 to 59 are raped in the UK each year. That's 232 women per day. 9 women every hour. So the notion that all women have achieved equality or are no longer suffering at the hands of the patriarchy is simply not true. Until complete equality is achieved, feminism as a concept clearly remains essential. It's the accessibility and understanding of the movement which Generation Z feminists are trying to reshape. You can buy Florence Gibbon's book, Women Don't Owe You Pretty, in all the usual places, published by Cassell, but do try to support your local independent bookshop. This is a Podimo podcast by Mermaid. I'm Chloe Combe. My producer is Rihanna Coleman, and our audio engineer is John Scott. And we've had production support from Gilly Archer. Hey, listener, whoever you are, if you're a parent or a teen, if you've ever been a teen, I want to hear from you. If you feel we've missed something, want to share your own experience, or have a question you'd like to be answered by a teen, I want to hear it. grab your phone, record a voice note, and send it over to me at chloe@hellomermaid.com. That email's also in the show notes. Seriously, I will be listening to them all. I can't wait to hear from you.